This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The city of Los Angeles to do this, no one wanted to build it. No major company in the United States was willing to build it. No one in the black community or in the political community here had even heard of cable. They didn't know what it was about. We came in and said, okay, we'll put up the money that's necessary, which was at that point was about $35 million, to do the system. We had access to a lot of doctors. My brother was a doctor. I was in the investment banking industry. And we said, let's put up the money because the community needs it. And it's something that can be very valuable because information is key. And, you know, the being locked out of the technology age basically was the equivalent of being locked out of reading in the 1800s. Mm-hmm. Unless you had access to technology, you can't have access to all the information that goes on in this country. And we don't have it.
So what happened? Just tell us a little bit more about what happened in the process of trying to obtain this license.
So when we went down to City Hall and explained to them what we wanted to do, and they referred us to one of the councilmen there and said, well, you know, he'll help you work through the bureaucratic process, because there's a large bureaucratic process down in Los Angeles. It's a big city. And in the second meeting that the councilman's deputy had with my brother, he told my brother that we needed to give them control of our company in order to do business here. And neither my brother nor I were willing to accept that as a, given in terms of doing business, that you had to do that. So they said, well, unless you do this way, we're going to do everything we can to prevent you from getting into the cable industry. So we said, well, go for it and do it the best you can do. We went through the entire process, which took 3 years of, several million dollars of engineering studies and various studies that were necessary for what the city had asked for. We had to prove our ability to finance the system, and we did that. The city said, well, yes, you have all the money, and then right before they were ready to award the license, they said, no, you don't have the money. They said, well, how can you change that in the middle of the process? They said, because we feel like it. That was pretty much their answer. We want to do it. We'll do it. When we went out and got the money a second time, we got a large investment banking firm to come and commit the money. They said, we don't accept investment banking commitments, which is standard of American finance. So when we did that, we went out and got the richest man in the world to back us, who at that time was named Adnan Khashoggi out of Saudi Arabia. They said, we don't accept letters of credit from Arabs and red Chinese. They're in an open forum on the floor of the L.A. City Council. And that was their position. So they said, no black person is going to get this. So we went through that process. When the process was done, they said, well, you can come back and bid again. We said, well, we probably waste our time. If we've done this once and you've cheated us already, why do it? At that point, we decided that our only protection from the L.A. city government was the federal courts. So we took the case into U.S. District Court, filed the case against the city for violating our civil rights, our First Amendment rights, the right to speak, because the cable runs on what's known as a public right-of-way. Like you see newspapers on a corner, cable runs on a pole that's controlled and owned by the public. The U.S. Supreme Court ultimately ruled on this in 1986 and said, in a unanimous decision, 9-0 against the city, that if there's room on the pole, you cannot restrict a cable television system to only one company, because that would be violating the Constitution. The case was then remanded back to the U.S. District Court Judge Consuela Marshall, who we had originally filed the case with, and she dismissed our case within like 20 days and told us to just get lost. Their assumption was we would run out of money before they ran out of time. They came close, but they were wrong. So we went through the process. She got the case in 1986 being referred back from the Supreme Court, which had already defined what the law was, and she simply sat on our case for 6 years and refused to allow us to go to trial. In 10 years in federal court, we never got a trial. We never did anything. The case of Preferred Communications versus the City of Los Angeles is one of the most widely referred to cases in the First Amendment regarding, cable television, radio, anything. And if people were to Google that case, they would see this 20 pages of Google about the case Preferred Communications versus the City of Los Angeles. We came back and all we could do was basically go through the court process. We couldn't force the judge. We tried everything we could do to force the judge to give us a trial and to bring it before a jury. She simply refused because she had been friends of Tom Bradley, who was the mayor here, and had worked for the city in the city attorney's office, who was the agency who was prosecuting for the city.
So that's
where we ended up at.
So before you and your brother began, when you were planning this, did you even envision there'd be such a battle?
No, not at all. we thought people would be happy that we would come in and be willing to had the money to come and do it. And, you know, we were both licensed professionals. We thought they would be actually appreciative that we would be willing to go into South Central because nobody wanted to do it. No one wanted to build South Central because it was poor and crime-ridden. And so we thought we'd be received very well, you know. Why would you anyone want to object to investing $30 million into the poorest community in the country?
Now, you had a predecessor who had also tried, but you were unaware of his efforts. Could you elaborate a little bit on that?
Well, one of the people we were working with was named Edgar Charles. Edgar had been involved in trying to bring cable television into the city since about 1972. At that point, Mayor Tom Bradley was still in the Los Angeles City Council. He passed a bill that put a moratorium on any new franchises being awarded after that in order to allow the city to catch up with technology, so he said. And he was the one who prevented Edgar Charles and the group before him from trying to build the cable system then. So when Edgar joined with us, we had his knowledge about what they had done and how long this had gone on. It actually had gone on since the early 1970s. But they had locked out everyone and said no one could get it because we're not going to allow a license to be issued for this area. So they were locked out, and we came in. He joined us. Unfortunately, right before we filed the application, he was killed in an accident in Las Vegas for doing a nonprofit thing.
Okay, I am puzzled. Tom Bradley, you know, widely known, nationally known. Los Angeles, a very diverse area. Couldn't you go to him for support? I mean, why would there not be support in that particular area for an African-American company stepping up to do something that is going to benefit a number of people, but certainly a significant number of African-Americans?
Well, let me say that with two things. One, Los Angeles is one of the most corrupt cities in this country. I don't know what people think in other cities, but I've lived in New York and I've been around Chicago and Philly. There are very few cities that can show the blatant level of outright corruption that L.A. shows. The main issue came down to black politicians wanted us to give out control to their black friends and people who were well-known and people who were, you know, very supposed to be civil rights leaders. But they came to us and said, look, if you give us two-thirds of your company, we'll allow you to do business. They only wanted to sell the system off very quickly and try to make a quick profit. Our goal was not making a quick profit. I already had a good job. I was working for an investment banking firm in Beverly Hills. I had a good job. The issue became, who's going to control the minds of black America? That's what the issue came down to. The Democratic Party was basically aligned against us here in Los Angeles and used every effort and every means they could to prevent us from getting that done. And so they started off with the position of, we'll take two-thirds of your company and we'll allow you to put up all the money and all the technical skills, but we'll own two-thirds of it. And that made no sense. That's not how you do business.
Now, you had formed earlier a 60-40 joint venture, and you had a limited liability corporation that replaced Mr. Charles's Ebony cable television. So were these people part of the Mesbic?
No, we didn't have anything to do with Mesbics. We didn't want any government money. All we wanted to do was use private money, and the only thing we wanted from the government was to get out of our way. We didn't need their money, we didn't want their money, and we didn't want their participation in our speaking of the First Amendment rights that are necessary for us to help our community in South Central. Our actual application was a joint venture with a company called Six Star Nielsen, which was building the Hollywood Wilshire franchise and had already been approved and was building a franchise here right next to South Central. It made sense for them to extend over to us because we were going to put up 60% of the equity, they would put up 40% of the equity. And we would jointly get the debt financing that was necessary. But having somebody with the experience and the background in cable gave us a step up because they knew what we were trying to do. They also had access to money, and we had access to money. The problem became that when political figures and those who have put up large sums of money for for Tom Bradley's campaign for governor, got to the point they felt that they were entitled to own anything that went on in South Central. And that was where we had a problem. We didn't see how it was their business what we did. We weren't adverse to them building a second system. If you want to do a system, build a second system. But in terms of you coming in and taking our money and putting it up against what you want to do, that's not going to work. So we formed the joint venture, and that joint venture was the one that bid with the city for the franchise. And we thought, with having the money, having the technical expertise, since they'd already approved our partners for building another system there, they couldn't complain that they didn't have the skills to do it. So it came down to either you have the political power to do it, which we didn't. We had access to one councilman, and they had three councilmen and the mayor. But the mayor's office was really the power behind this. And that's where it really came from. The mayor sat us down and said, look, if you don't do business the way my friends say do business, you can't do business here in the city.
So,
and, it sounded like gangster business to me. And to me, giving that sort of money to political figures would end us up in jail. That's all I could see. I could see a big legal problem with paying off political figures to get a license to do business here. And they thought nothing about it. I think the thing that really upset me the most is they took it as just routine. They were used to doing this. This was not something newer they came up with. This is how they did business in City Hall. Everybody has to pay somebody who knows somebody. And paying them is one thing, but giving them two-thirds of your company is a different thing.
So knowing all that, and all that time passing when the judge sat on this, what kept you going? Why did you keep going? Why did you keep pushing it?
Because it's our responsibility. You know, with every right goes a responsibility. We wanted our First Amendment rights because we knew that our community could not grow, prosper, and benefit and get better without having the right to speak among themselves, without it being filtered through someone else. The issue, you know, we came from New York, so we're not used to people just coming up to you and telling you, give me your money or else. So the situation was one where we felt we had an obligation to the community as well as to ourselves to follow everything all the way through. Granted, it's a lot of money that went on the line, and we lost a lot of money in it. But at what point are you willing to sell out your people? It's once you get past price, it's about principle. So it's the price. Again, they offered us several $1 million to get out. That was not the issue because we turned them down for that. But the issue became, at what point, basically to do what they wanted us to do, we would have to sell out the entire black community of South Central and allow them to come in and take control and sell it off very quickly without ever having the ability to program a system that we needed. That's where we get black shows, black leaders, and things like that. We can't know what our leaders are doing unless someone tells us. But who's telling us? It's not black people telling us. It's white people telling us. And that may, some of it may be true, some of it's not. When it came to Tom Bradley, most of the things we heard after I met him, I found were completely untrue. Not only was he not honest, but he wasn't very bright. So, you know, the combination of those made a difficult time for South Central, and people have wondered why there were riots going on. Because if you don't have the ability to express yourself in a free society, you're going to turn to violence. And that's what's happened too many times in South Central.
Okay.
They had the Watts riots, and they had the 92 riots after the Rodney King decision.
Okay, you are listening to KBOO Portland. This is Black Book Talk. We are talking to Clinton E. Galloway, the author of The Anatomy of a Hustle, which is recounting his company's attempt to get the cable franchise for South Central LA. Okay, another question. Cable started with many promises. As I recall, it was the promise that, you know, prices would be reasonable for those, probably graded for those who couldn't afford it. That was a big thing, you know, when people were going to meetings in Detroit. It was like, well, yes, we'll have it gauged so senior citizens and whoever couldn't afford it would have it, various gradations at that level. And also that in addition to whatever programming would come into the community, that the community would be encouraged to do its own programming and just lots of wonderful things that made people very enthusiastic. Do you think, not necessarily just where you live, but do you think anywhere that cable has fulfilled its promise?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. The ability to have a monopoly and control over all the media, they became the gatekeeper over all media. Regardless of what your station was, unless they approved you going on, you could not go on. Therefore, you had no distribution. So they talked about prices at the beginning because that was what the politicians wanted to hear. They wanted to pretend they were going to do something. But with an unregulated monopoly, which is very unusual in the United States, phone companies and utility companies are regulated. This was one of the few unregulated monopolies that existed in the country. And it was created by government corruption. The entire industry. They didn't bother to all this $10 and making it available
yes,
for senior citizens and the low income. They wouldn't do it. we wanted to do it because that was our community, and we thought that others would want to pay for, you know, we thought education was a big and important issue that people would be willing to pay for separately because education was so poor in South Central and the children were not learning anything. So those were the issues. Our issues were less entertainment issues than there were knowledge issues about getting your rights, about understanding what the educational system meant, about medical issues that, you know, as the AIDS epidemic broke a pandemic here, no one was telling anything was being told in the South Central community, where it was running rampant. And again, that was a lack of availability of media. The media didn't care because it wasn't their children suffering. But, in summary, no, they didn't do any of that. They didn't provide the access that they claimed they would provide. They didn't provide the programming that they claimed they would provide. And the only black television station that was created was BET, which was fundamentally owned by a cable company, and Bob Johnson took over control. But they did very little in terms of original programming. They mainly played music videos and things they got for free. So, again, the issue of how do we identify ourselves was not an issue for them. They didn't care. That's an important issue.
Can we back up a little bit just to the BET thing? When BET started, as I recall, they did have more than music videos. Bev Johnson had a program. Her program, I think, hers was just talk. Tavis Smiley, they had a program about books. So there was a time when BET had a variety of programs, and this is before they were purchased by Viacom. Over the years, that did change, and I remember somebody saying something to Johnson about it and him becoming, I think, sort of defensive and saying, well, you know, we have to do what people pay for, and, you know, people are paying for us to show them, I don't know, I'm sure he didn't say booty-shaking stuff, but that's essentially a lot of what it was. That was the criticism. So why do you think that BET had to change its format at that time?
It became cheaper to get free music videos because the music videos they got were free. They didn't have to pay for those. These were just record companies introducing these music videos and pushing them to the public through BET. But they were given this was programming they didn't have to pay to develop, that's why you saw so much of it on television. But it gave a disproportionate image of the violence that was going on in the community, and it allowed people to legitimize things like the thug life or the gang life as being a valid alternative to your lifestyle.
Okay.
And to have if you don't have something to counter that, now I'm not against people saying whatever they please. That's what the free speech is about. But unless you have something to counter that, and our counter was, let's talk about education, let's talk about reading. You'd be surprised how many kids get out of high school here who can't even read.
No, we wouldn't.
No, we wouldn't.
Okay,
but
thank you.
It was just a tragedy because my parents came from Birmingham, Alabama, and brought us to New York, and education was stressed from the time I can ever remember.
Absolutely.
As being one of the most important things you can do to improve the quality of your life. And it's turned out to be true. But it had to be stressed to us to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the ability to stress it to our children because we don't control the media, and the media dominates what our children think. It's not the parents who dominate, it's the media that dominates.
I knew you might have been from Birmingham when you used the term Mother Dear. But
that is a giveaway, isn't it?
but what are you doing now to try and promote this book? It is a recipe of political insight and how economics work hand in hand with the politics of various communities, not only in L.A., but throughout this nation. Are you traveling now or what?
I've done some book signings here. I do a lot of radio and television interviews, as much as we can get. And the problem is, in Los Angeles, you can't get any exposure. The L.A. Times does not cover it. The major black publication, the L.A. Sentinel, does not cover it because one of the participants in this, Danny Bakewell, is now the owner of the L.A. Sentinel. Because he was friends with the mayor, and he was one of the guys who wanted us to give him 2/3 of the company. So he's not going to cover it. So we go out and we basically tell our story any way we can. We tell it on radio. We've spoken, at the Annenberg School of Communications in Los Angeles. We've had book signings. We do a lot of radio. We've done NPR. We've done the Tavis Smiley Show on radio. We've gotten some exposure, but again, it's very difficult in Los Angeles, which you'd think would be the major place that people would be interested in what went on. But, when you don't have access to media, you're stuck with pushing it as the best way you can. And so we've tried to market it. We've been fortunate enough to Cornell, who found an interest in the book and allowed it to be spoken before the public.
Okay.
Have you been to the Northwest?
No, I mean, we've spoken in to stations in Seattle, but Portland is really probably the second one we've done in the Northwest. We've done a lot in the East, Baltimore, New York, Detroit, Chicago, and we've done some in the Midwest. But in Los Angeles or the Southern California area, we get no coverage whatsoever on this book. And that's very difficult to understand. But again, it's not, because when we were doing this, the LA Times was one of the largest cable companies in the country. So they weren't covering it the way they should have, because they didn't want competition. And competition was the basis of, you know, any free market. Any free media must have competition. And so we've seen the media has consolidated with the government to basically give us a bunch of, you know, talk about things that they're doing, but none of it's really real. The media and the government are so tied, I call it an unholy alliance, because when government wants to get elected, they get a bunch of money and give it to media. Media, in turn, limits what it criticizes the government about. And that's the job of media, is to criticize and oversee government, and that's why the First Amendment was created. Because without that, who's going to tell us what they're really doing? We don't know what they're really doing in Washington. They're doing anything, but nothing that's benefiting most people in America, be they black or white. They're doing everything against it's a class war at this point, where the average person in the middle class are being slaughtered, but the rich can get more.
Yes. What do you see as the future of cable?
Well, cable is coming towards the end of its power source. The key that's going to be dependent on cable is this net neutrality law. They control broadband. The Internet, now you see a lot of young people now don't even get cable. They
right.
use the Internet to get all the information they need.
Mm-hmm.
But with broadband, the cable companies want to eliminate the concept of net neutrality, where all things are transmitted at the same speed. They want to decide what programming can be transmitted at what speed. Therefore, if a movie is about something they don't want to see, they'll say it takes 2 hours for you to load this movie versus something that they want you to see. It could take 10 minutes to load the movie. Unless there's a complete net neutrality, then cable is going to try to hold as long as they can to that power. The power becomes the citizen. The citizen must stand up and say, hey, look, the people who are supposed to represent us are not representing us. Black leadership has become a joke. Bob Johnson recently did a study about black leadership. He said 40% of black America don't believe anyone speaks for them. They said when they talked about the NAACP, 9% said they thought the NAACP spoke for them. The majority of black Americans don't feel anybody speaks for them. They certainly don't feel that politicians speak for them. They said, what do you feel about Maxine Waters? They say 11% said she speaks for us. So 1 in 10 people think that politicians may actually speak for them. That's not a way to generate a vibrant community and economic development within that community. Part of that has to come with government involvement, because you can't raise money and bring money without the government approving it. Well, they're not putting up the money. They're just saying you can't raise it.
This is a very, very interesting conversation. You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO. Now, one thing I would like to know. Outside of L.A., are you planning to distribute this book to various reading groups, or how are you going about this?
We're trying. Yeah, we have a public relations firm that represents us. We've sent the book out to a number of various organizations, including journalism schools at, you know, Tuskegee, A&M, Prairie View, Hampton, a number of schools that we think the information is, it's the story that's important. It's the story of what happens when government gets out of hand. And it's been out of hand in black America since the 1980s. It's now out of hand in white America, and now they're all complaining and want to see what we can do.
One other question.
We've tried going across the country and letting everyone know that the book is available. We're, you know, we have a website, anatomyofahustle.com, and it points you to all the various interviews that we've done. It points you to the case that if you actually press the button, Preferred Communications versus the City of Los Angeles, you'll get 20 pages of Google things that refer to our case. When you win a Supreme Court case 9-0, you expect that the law is going to change and they're going to give you your rights. But that's turned out not to be true. And who it turned out not to be true from was a black judge. A black U.S. District Court judge simply decided we would not get our rights. And when she found out our rights had been violated, it wasn't she found out. The court had already said in 86 that our rights had been violated. She decided that the value of a black man's rights were $1.
You know,
and if that is so, then what are our rights? Do we really have rights?
I feel like this book there should be another subtitle to this book called Losing Our Innocence for those who may have it. Again, for our listeners, we've been talking to Clinton E. Galloway, the author of Anatomy of a Hustle. Please do read this book because it's talking about more than the cable industry. The things that are said here can apply in many places. Ms. Galloway, thank you so much for joining us today on Black Book Talk.
Thank you for having me. It's just a pleasure to be here. And, you know, it's people like you who allow it, the information to get out to the public. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. So, farewell for the May edition of Black Book Talk. Join us next month when we'll be talking to Dr. Maya Angelou. This is the Library Lady saying goodbye.
O.B. Hill.
Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman. See you next month.
Bye-bye.
We're really happy here with this lonely game we're playing. Looking for words to say. Searching but not finding understanding.
It's time for the KABU News at Noon. I'm Kristen Yount. Two Iranian nationals have been found guilty of conspiring to blow up Western targets in Kenya. A Kenyan court found that Ahmed Mohammed and Saeed Mansour are guilty of conspiring to cause great harm. The pair led officials to 33 pounds of deadly RDX explosives hidden at a golf course when they were arrested last year. They face 15 years in prison. The UN admits that 250,000 have died in a Somali famine in only 18 months. The drought in 2010 should have tipped officials off to the oncoming food crisis, but the world body failed to act in time to save 4.6% of Somalia's population. A famine happens when at least one-fifth of households cannot eat, 30% of people have acute malnutrition, and there are more than 2 deaths in 10,000 every day. Somalia's devastating civil war has made the country extremely dangerous for aid workers for 2 decades. The troubled Pegasus pipeline that ruptured last month in the Mayflower, Arkansas, has breached again this week. Last time, it leaked in Donopan, Missouri, about 180 miles northeast of the Arkansas site. It is unclear why the 858-mile Pegasus line, built in the late 1940s, still leaks when it was supposedly shut down last month. This time, a much smaller leak was observed seeping up through one family's residence. The leak has damaged plants and may contaminate the well water there. Exxon crews are excavating the leak. Only one barrel of tar sands crude leaked out compared to the 5,000 barrels last month. A barrel is equal to 42 gallons. Multnomah County will release a budget in early June after hearings in May. The Budget Board Chairman Jeff Cogan says that service cuts won't be an issue for the first time in over a decade. A one-time increase in the general fund means money injections into some county programs and infrastructure. Multnomah County facilities will get necessary upgrades. A new health clinic at 33rd and Powell will have some funding. And $1 million is earmarked to support a program for access to housing for homeless citizens. Youth internship programs will double, and there will be an increase in Sun School funding. It has been 10 years since Portland police officer Scott McAllister shot Kendra James to death on the Skidmore Overpass in Portland. Miss James, an unarmed 25-year-old, attempted to flee police in a car. The driver's side door remained open, her hands presumably on the wheel. Family members are expected to attend a vigil for Miss James this Sunday, May 5th at 5 p.m. at the Greater Faith Baptist Church at 931 North Skidmore. The public is welcome. Weather in Portland today is pretty not too bad, with highs in the upper 70s, a gentle wind, and all sunshine. It's KABU News at Noon. I'm Kristen Yount. Tune in to KABU Monday through Friday at 5 p.m. for the latest in local, national, and international news. Curated by volunteers and produced by amateurs and enjoyed by many.
And you're listening to Community Radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM, Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM, Corvallis and Albany, and we are at K220HR Hood River and K264AA Corvallis. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery. Committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at our carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia, information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. And this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW.